We're going to listen back to an interview with the British film director Anthony Minghella. He died yesterday at the age of 54 from complications following surgery for tonsil cancer. Minghella won an Academy Award for directing the film The English Patient. His other movies include Truly Madly Deeply, Cold Mountain, Breaking and Entering, and The Talented Mr. Ripley. When I spoke with him in 1999, we talked first about writing and directing The Talented Mr. Ripley. It's based on the Patricia Highsmith novel of the same name and received an Oscar nomination for Best Screenplay. It begins when a wealthy industrialist wants to convince his son to return home from the bohemian life he's living in Italy. The father mistakenly believes that a young man named Tom Ripley is his son's old chum from Princeton and offers to send Ripley to Italy to talk his son into coming home. Ripley, who is broke, wants that free trip, so he doesn't admit he's not the son's friend. In this scene, Ripley, played by Matt Damon, has just arrived in Italy. Making it look like a chance encounter, he goes up to the wealthy son Dickie, played by Jude Law, and Dickie's girlfriend, played by Gwyneth Paltrow.
Dickie Greenleaf?
Who's that?
It's Tom. Tom Ripley.
Tom Ripley?
We were at Princeton together.
Okay. Did we know each other?
Hello. Well, I knew you, so I suppose you must have known me.
Princeton's like a fog. America's like a fog. This is Marge Sherwood. Sorry, what is it?
Ripley.
How do you do?
How do you do, Marge?
Once Tom Ripley gets a taste of Dickie's life, his money, his freedom, his charisma, he wants it for himself and goes to extremes to get it. Dickie is a jazz fan, an amateur saxophonist. In a scene set in a jazz club, Dickie sits in on saxophone and invites Ripley to sing. Before we hear my conversation with Anthony Minghella, here's that scene with Matt Damon as Ripley singing.
My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Unphotographable, yet you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak? When you open it to speak, are you smart?
When the Matt Damon character of Tom Ripley prepares to meet Dickie, the wealthy young American who's living in Italy, he studies up on some of the things that Dickie knows so he could kind of impress him and be on the same wavelength. So he studies up on jazz because Dickie is an amateur jazz saxophonist. And so he gives himself his own like blindfold test. He plays records and tries to guess like who's playing on it. How did you choose which performances you wanted to use? Were there certain like iconic figures of the time or records that were special to you that you wanted to get in? I mean, for example, there's a scene where he sings a la Chet Baker, My Funny Valentine. Why that particular performance? Why make that the centerpiece?
Well, I thought particularly about Chet Baker. First of all, there's something so intimate and secretive about that song and the performance of that version of the song.
Yeah, well put.
And I think it was an opportunity for Matt to sing to Jude or Ripley to sing to Dickie in a way that I think really illuminates the whole business of the popular song, because if you look at any dance floor when a ballad is playing and you see lovers crooning into each other's ears and they're saying things in song that they would never have the nerve to say without the cloak of music around them. It's very hard, you know, for a man to say to a woman, your lips are laughable and photographable, but you're my favorite work of art. But you can say that if it's sung to a simple melody. And I think the whole allure of a popular song is it enables us to speak from our heart, but with the ballast of music. And so that seemed to be, you know, a very good choice of song for Ripley. And it also, finally, I always felt that Chet Baker acted his songs rather than sang them. And so I felt confident that Matt could act as Ripley, that song to Dickie.
Tom Ripley, the character, says it's better to be a fake somebody than a real nobody. Frank Rich, writing in the New York Times Magazine section, said, in this age of rampant reinvention, when political candidates, entrepreneurs, and criminals change selves like quicksilver, the talented Mr. Ripley may be Hollywood's most chilling and up-to-date portrait of our national character. What do you personally relate to about the character of Tom Ripley? Because there must be some personal connection there.
Oh, I think I felt huge connection to Ripley when I read reread the novel when I came to adapt it. I think essentially it's this feeling of being on the outside of things, of being strange in some way, of feeling too that you have to be secret about what makes you particular. That I suppose it goes back to the sense of being in a schoolyard when teams are being selected and the fear of not being chosen, the fear of not being admitted really to a life that you aspire to. And particularly in Britain, where I was brought up, where I think the issues of class are tattooed on your forehead. You walk around with second rate and second class imprinted on your forehead. Then I think that I'm very, very alert to the striations of class and to the sense that there's a better life being lived, that your nose is pressed up against the window of a life. And you know, my family is Italian, and I was growing up on a small island off the coast of Britain. So I felt there were so many membranes between me and what seemed to be the center of things. And that, you know, I don't want to make any special claim for that, because I think all of us have within us some reference to what it feels like to be on the outside. And those were my particular things. I mean, I was perfectly happy growing up. It's just that I always felt in some way that I didn't entirely belong. And I think that feeling of not belonging is particularly exacerbated in, you know, late adolescence, early adulthood, which is really where this story is situated. It's very much a story of young people trying to reinvent themselves in the country of Italy, in Europe, which I think had particular attraction to Americans over the course of this century.
Now, you said that part of the reason why you kind of have this sense of empathy for Tom Ripley is that you felt a bit of an outsider growing up in an Italian family that had emigrated to Britain and lived in the Isle of Wight. Now, which part of your family came first there? Was it your grandparents, your parents?
Well, it's a very convoluted story, but essentially my mother had fetched up in the Isle of Wight just after the war, but basically on the advice of a priest. Her family had settled from a small village in Italy near Monte Cassino, and her father had disappeared off to Ireland, I think to lead a completely new life, and had abandoned my grandmother and her three daughters. And so with the wisdom and the navigation of the local parish priest in Scotland, where they, for some reason, were living, they were redirected down to the Isle of Wight, a place they'd never heard of, and probably they just wanted to get rid of them. And so, which is as far south as you can go in the British Isles, so they went down to the island. And my father, meanwhile, was living in a village very close to Valvery, where my mother came from, and was brought over, as many young men were brought either to America or to Britain, where the wealthy families would pay their train ticket or airfare, and in a way to provide cheap labor. And he was taken in by an ice cream making firm in Portsmouth, which is a few miles from the island. And the people there said, well, you know, there's a girl who comes from a village next door to you in Italy across the way. And so they ended up courting each other on the Isle of Wight ferry there's a long pier and ride, and I think they would troll up and down the pier in the morning, then my father would go back to the work, and eventually he married and they settled on the island, and I was born a couple of years later.
I want to ask you something else about your family. I know your father ended up making ice cream, and I think that there was a brand called Minghella ice cream, is that right?
That's absolutely true, yeah.
So were you, I mean, would this have been like being the son of Ben and Jerry's or something, or the son of Seal Test when I was young? Or
I wish it had been the son of
Ben
and Jerry's. I would never have got a job. I just would have retired by now. Funnily enough, I think one of the Ripley experiences I had when I was growing up was that on the island, which is essentially a very poor place, it's a wonderful place, but the 90% of the population live from hand to mouth. But it has this border of large, you know, of rich people, extremely privileged people who descend in the summer months. It's always been, since Queen Victoria's time, it's been a place where the wealthy and privileged have gone to spend their summers. There's a big, you know, boating regatta there every year, Cowes, which is the home of sailing. And so it was very much the experience of my growing up that the island would become full. I wouldn't use the word infested, although that was the word that came to my mind. It was full of the young and privileged and gorgeous and wealthy every summer while we were toiling away. And my summers were always spent behind the glass of an ice cream van serving ice cream. And I certainly remember the feeling of not being inside the world I wanted to be in, but rather imprisoned in the cage of this ice cream van. And I remember once driving along, delivering some ice cream in my father's van, and being stopped by two young, very beautiful people who could very well have been Dickie Greenleaf and Maude Sherwood, who wanted me to give them a ride. And so they got into my van, and after a while I asked them where they were going, and they said, "Oh, we're not going anywhere. We just wanted to sort of feel what it was like to be picked up by a local and taken somewhere." And I never felt so humiliated and so clear about my own social standing. And I remember vowing then that I would escape from the prison of the ice cream van and try and reinvent myself. So I suppose that was my most defining Ripley moment.
When you were trying to reinvent yourself, and when you were becoming, you know, a young writer and everything, did people meet you and go, "Oh, Minghella, is that like the ice cream family, Minghella?"
Well, unfortunately, I'd like to say that was true, but my father's ice cream was really only sold on the island and just in the sort of vicinity, and I'd run away far enough to the university not to be identified as the sort of purveyor of raspberry ripple. But I remember one thing that was, I mean, first of all, you know, you talk a lot about, you know, where the Ripley element in you comes from, and this feeling of alienation as a child or whatever. But I had the best childhood, and my parents are incredibly close to me. In fact, they're in the movie. They were in The English Patient as well. And
Wait, who are they in the movie? Who are they in Ripley? What,
you see my father playing bocce in the square with Jude Law. They're standing next to each other. My mother's sitting in a seat beside them, and they're just in that scene because they came out to visit, and they were in The English Patient playing accordions and singing. And they're a very, very significant part of my life. And so I would hate it to sound like I was bewailing a childhood, which was in fact, you know, a wonderful one and a rich one. And I think that often the very things which make you feel strange as a child are the things which become incredibly precious to you as an adult. And the feeling of being a foreigner, and the feeling of, we had a cafe and there was never really any private life. Our private life was played out in, you know, the environment of a cafe kitchen. So every triumph and every failure was always paraded in front of the staff or in front of some customers. And that was, you know, sometimes quite soul-destroying as a child. But looking back on it, I think it was the most wonderful way of understanding myself and understanding the way the world worked. And so I feel now it's all privilege. But I remember that reading about Fellini, who's one of my, you know, cinema heroes, and his father was a seller of olive oil and sausage and salami and prosciutto, and he would talk about his father coming home from selling, carrying a big piece of prosciutto or a bottle of wine, and saying, "I make the best wine and the best this, and I can't sell it, and what's wrong with people?" And Fellini quietly vowing to himself he would never, ever sell anybody anything. And I had exactly the same experience when I used to drive around in my ice cream van playing The Happy Wanderer on the chimes and thinking, one day I'll escape from all of this. I'll never sell anybody anything. And just like Fellini, 20 years later, I find myself in Hollywood, you know, trying to sell my own brand of ice cream. So I think we all come back to ourselves in some way.
Was The Happy Wanderer like the theme of the truck or something?
Ding, 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 ding. It just to drive me out of my mind.
In fact,
I must say that when I was with Gabrielle Yared and we were talking about the music for Ripley, and I was trying to think of some way of finding a noise that would be intensely nostalgic and disturbing for Ripley, we came up with something which is perilously like the tune on my ice cream van. I mean, it's just a music box sound. And I know it's partly because of that, and it's partly because my grandmother had a music box in her room, which was from Venice. It was just a gondola with a ballerina dancing on it, and it was the saddest tune. And I think somehow those two sounds, because when Gabriel and I are working on the score, we work together in his studio, and I'm sure that the provenance of both of that particular theme in the film, this very strange and music box like theme, comes both from the ice cream van and the gondola in my grandmother's bedroom.
Wow, I'm still registering on me having to drive all day with the Happy Wanderer, Valderie, Valdera, my knapsack on my back.
That's it.
Oh,
except that they were clockwork chimes, and so you would wind them up, and by the time you got to the end of your street, they'd begun to wind down, and so it's given me a particularly sensitive ear to pitch as I've become an adult.
Before I let you go, I have to ask you, did you ever see the Seinfeld episode, everybody must ask you this, in which Elaine went to see the English Patient and didn't like it, but her boss Peterman loves it, and so rather than get into a fight with him, she tells him she didn't see it. So if he, of course, has to do everything in his power to get her to go because he's sure she's going to love it. Everyone must ask you if you've seen the episode. Did you see it?
Well, you know, I saw a piece of it when I was in Los Angeles. I hadn't seen the whole episode. I was enormously flattered that they took the trouble even to... it was an index to me of how much The English Patient had pervaded the public consciousness, that anybody would be remotely amused by this. And in fact, in Britain, there was a much more sort of devastating and just devastatingly funny attack on The English Patient, which was called The Toy Patient, in which they dressed up some bears and, you know... woolen rabbits and played out the story with puppets, and it was much funnier and much better than my film. So I just took it as a great compliment, really, that anybody cared enough.
I think
the other thing I would say is this, you know, is that I feel so uniconoclastic as a filmmaker, and it's always very strange to me that people can either be so passionately for or against what I'm doing, because I feel like the most equivocal person in the world. And when I made Truly Madly Deeply, I remember that in 1 week, I remember reading a list of somebody's 10 favorite films of all time and getting that glow of pride and reading that somebody thought this was one of the 10 best movies ever made. And the next day on BBC television, they had a wonderful program where people could consign the things they most hated to Room 101, this program was called. And the very first thing on the next day that I saw was this guy saying, and the first thing I put in Room 101 is Truly Madly Deeply. So it just seems extraordinary to me that such an equivocal person and such an equivocal filmmaker should excite, you know, such extreme reactions in people.
Film director Anthony Minghella recorded in 1999. He died yesterday at the age of 54 from complications following surgery for tonsil cancer. He had just completed work on an adaptation of the novel The Number One Ladies Detective Agency, which is a pilot for a BBC and HBO series. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.